Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 33, the apogee of democracy. Who are the voters of Singapore and what do they want? This is the question that every Singapore politician faces, and this question was particularly apropos in 1957. From the very beginning, as the debate in Singapore over the expansion of electoral politics began, there were those who raised doubts about the nature of Singapore's electorate. Some politicians and officials expressed doubts about the maturity of the electorate, predicting that they would succumb to populism, manipulation, vote-buying, or communal agitation. Others had greater faith in the wisdom of the voter and further argued that the only way to combat populism or narrow appeals was to fully enfranchise all of Singapore's residents to ensure full representation. Only when everyone has a vote can you then ensure that politicians have to govern on behalf of everyone. In 1957, the constitutional agreement with the British fully enfranchised Singaporeans. It would create an entirely elected legislature with full internal self-government. Now, we would find out what Singaporean voters really wanted. Of course, in one key way, what they really wanted had already been denied to them. The British colonial authorities, the Labour Front leader and Chief Minister Lim Yew Hock, and PAP leader Lee Kuan Yew had colluded to remove the most popular politicians in Singapore, the PAP left wing and David Marshall. The PAP left, of course, had been arrested and detained without trial, accused of subversion. The British wanted the field clear for their local collaborators, or less charitably, their opponents might have said, their running dogs. Lee Kuan Yew and Lim Yew Hock were the two right-wing politicians that they, the British, felt had the best chance of preserving British interests in Singapore. Lim and Lee, working on the principle that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, colluded with them to remove the most popular politicians in Singapore to clear the way for the two of them, one of the two of them, to win power. And so now, with the left wing locked up and David Marshall resigned from the assembly, the two of them would have to genuinely fight it out to win votes. And this was doubly true because going forward, repression would no longer be an option. The British were chastened from the Suez Crisis, so they were not going to sanction further repression. Nor did they need to. They were happy with the 1957 Constitutional Agreement. It preserved their influence and military bases in Singapore amidst the deteriorating situation in Indochina, while relieving them of significant responsibility. There was little pressure or expectation for further constitutional progress. The British had already given away all the powers they were expected to give away, short of full independence. And they didn't care if Lee Kuan Yew or Lim Yew Hock won. Of course, they preferred Lim Yew Hock as the more reliable partner, but Lee Kuan Yew was good too. So Lim and Lee would now face off in a final showdown. Ironically, because of this situation, where all the capable left-wing leaders were locked away, where repression was not politically possible, where the regulatory environment limited politics to the Legislative Assembly, this created Singapore's most representative and democratic period. Because without any other option available, Singapore's politicians had no choice but to compete for votes, fair and square. Which brings us back to our opening question. To win an election, you need to know the priorities of the electorate. What did the people of Singapore want? Well, throughout 1957 to 1959, voters got to express their opinion three times. First, the city council elections in 1957, and then a broad opinion survey in 1958, and finally, the general election of 1959. Let's start with the city council election. Singapore was split into two regions, the city region and the rural region, and both were governed by councils which handled things like public utilities, local services, rubbish collection, parking, housing regulations, and so forth. The city council had been elected in 1953 under the old electorate, while Singapore was still a full-fledged colony, and so it was dominated by representatives of European-linked business interests. It was a byword for corruption, incompetence, and colonial arrogance. And so the passage of the Local Government Bill in July 1957 was celebrated by the public as much for the end of the old corrupt elitist city council as for the promise of a fully representative and responsible new council. The elections in December 1957 would not only be a referendum on the current government, but also they were perceived as a real opportunity for immediate and concrete change. David Marshall, whom we mentioned and you will recall from previous episodes, had stepped down from the Legislative Assembly, had by this time returned from his study tour of China. He had learned from his time in politics and he recognized the need to build an organization behind him, a party. And so he formed the Workers' Party and announced their intention to contest the city council elections. The Workers' Party's inauguration on the 3rd of November 1957 marked the beginning of intense campaigning for the city council. All major parties' platforms agreed on the major ideological points. They were pro-labour, anti-colonial, progressive, and focused on ending colonial discrimination and improving the livelihood of city dwellers. Parties instead fought over who would best be able to deliver on these promises. And so here we can see that the desire of the electorate was clear, so clear that all the parties agreed pretty much on what they wanted and what should be delivered. Continuing their informal alliance, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew had agreed that the Labour Front, the Singapore Alliance and the PAP would not run against each other. But this was a very one-sided agreement. Governor Black noted that, quote, "the PAP has called the tune," unquote. He noted that the PAP had their pick of constituencies and had left the Labour Front the scraps. Because not only did Lee Kuan Yew no longer need Lim Yew Hock, but the Labour Front was now an electoral liability. Lee Kuan Yew had managed to escape the events of the previous year without taking any responsibility for the repression. Indeed, the voting public thought he was a victim of the repression since he was the leader of the PAP, which had been the target of much of the arrest. They did not know he had colluded in the repression with Lim Yew Hock. But Lim Yew Hock, by contrast, took the blame and the public saw him as a running dog of the British, as a pro-colonialist. And so, because of this, the election proceeded pretty much as you'd expect. Turnout was over 165,000 on a wet 21st December. It was almost 8 times the previous election in 1953, although just 33% of total voters. And voters delivered a massive rebuke to the Labour Front. It only won 4 seats out of the 16 they contested. The big winners were the PAP, which won 13 out of 14 seats contested, and the Workers' Party, which won 4 out of 5. The Conservative Liberal Socialist Party surprisingly won 7 seats, chiefly by defeating Labour Front candidates in street fights. In other words, this was a comprehensive anti-Labour Front election. It was a comprehensive repudiation of Lim Yew Hock's action, of his repression and his collaboration with the British over the previous year. The election marked the end of the Lim Yew Hock-Lee Kuan Yew informal alliance. The results left Lim worried and somewhat dispirited, recalled Governor Black. Minister for Education Chu Swee Kee clung to the script, declaring that, quote, "the city council elections have clearly revealed the presence of communist elements in Singapore and they are doing their utmost to bring about a regime suited to their purpose," unquote. But his statement was mocked by the public as revealing the desperation of the Labour Front. The Nanyang Shangbao, for example, wrote, quote, "whether the Labour Front can halt its slide is up to its leadership and how well they respond to the demands of the people," unquote. And had nothing to do with some mythic communist conspiracy. All commentators agreed that the overwhelming PAP victory made them favourites for the 1959 Legislative Assembly election. As the largest bloc in the council, the PAP, quote, will be obliged to accept the responsibilities of office and will no longer be able to play their accustomed role of irresponsible opposition, end quote, wrote Governor Black. Their victory also prompted a political realignment and further clarified Singapore politics into an anti-colonial left and a pro-British right. The PAP leadership was seeking Malay support following the blow of Samad Ismail's angry resignation from the party. It sought an alliance with UMNO, Singapore UMNO, in the city council, and UMNO leader Hamid Jumaat was eager. But then he received what was called a scorching letter from Tunku Abdul Rahman and was forced to decline. Singapore UMNO's upset left wing, they had wanted collaboration with the PAP, and so because this was blocked, they stormed out of the party and joined the PAP. Meanwhile, the Labour Front was torn between those who favoured moving to the left to win back the electorate and those who favoured aligning with UMNO and the Liberal Socialist Party in an anti-PAP coalition. Those on the left, who felt Lee had betrayed the left through their support to Marshall's Workers' Party. And so this is the basic configuration. We have the Workers' Party on the left, the PAP on the centre-left, and then the Labour Front, Singapore Alliance Government occupying the centre-right, and then the Liberal Socialist Party on the right. Turnover also occurred in the colonial offices, but with an emphasis on continuity. Nigel Morris, the police commissioner, retired, and Alan Blades, director special branch, moved over to become police commissioner. Alan Blades' deputy, Kor Kai Bo, was then promoted to director special branch. Governor Black moved on to become governor of Hong Kong, and so his number two, Chief Secretary William Good, was promoted to governor. The British remained worried about a replay of British Guyana in 1953, where the election of a left-wing government in April had, by that October, resulted in a suspension of the constitution. Quote, is the People's Action Party a communist conspiracy, or, failing that, a chosen instrument through which communism will attain its ends? They asked themselves. Yet, they had little choice but to allow the constitution to be run in good faith. They had to give it a chance, otherwise they would be seen as having acted in bad faith. They accepted that the people of Singapore wanted a left-wing government, and so any leader wanting to win elections, including Lee Kuan Yew, had to present himself as a left-winger, whether they actually were or not. In the new city council, Ong Eng Guan was elected mayor, and he quickly impressed the public with his plans, including slashing expenditure, producing a blueprint for improving infrastructure and living conditions, and reform of utility costs to make it more progressive and affordable. The Nanyang Shangpao commented that, quote, this blueprint as a whole is very correct, end quote, and it urged people to give the plan their fullest support. Equally importantly, city council meetings were conducted in four languages, for the first time instead of just in English. The council resolved to employ as many graduates from Chinese, Malay and Indian schools as possible and to teach all council employees Malay. A public complaints bureau was established to address corruption and incompetence. The Nanyang Shangpo happily called these all correct steps. The Sinchu Jitpo similarly praised the multilingualism and practical approach of the city council, as well as proposals to set up an information section to inform the public of council affairs and translate the vernacular press for council staff. This, declared the Nanyang Shangpao, was an excellent response to those in Singapore and abroad who feared the election of left-wing parties would lead to extremism, and it wrote, quote, if the existing departments of the government follow the new city council in suppressing bureaucratic misconduct, raising efficiency, purging corruption and malpractices, facing reality squarely by accepting public complaints, and finding reasonable ways and means to stop the squandering of public funds and extortion of the people. We believe that any political party which may come into power would be given the confidence and the support by the people so long as they are not making empty promises. Unquote. And indeed, by the end of the city council's first month, by the end of January 1958, surveys found the city residents of Singapore heartily in favour of the new city council. The British were also heartened by this. One report noted that the city council, quote, under Ong Eng Guan's capable leadership, seems to be showing a determination to provide Singapore with an efficient, incorrupt, and responsible administration identified of the interests of the mass of the population, unquote. And this gave the British hope. In any event, their strategy was clear, quote, it remains our determination to stay in Singapore until she can merge into the Federation of Malaya and to prevent her falling under communist domination. The best we can do is to hold the ring and hold it fairly, unquote. Accordingly, Governor Good's intention was to stay above the political fray. He remained skeptical of the PAP, but he wrote, quote, I see little likelihood of the PAP administration of the City Council discrediting the party before the Legislative Assembly elections, unquote. Lim Yew Hock would have little choice but to sit back and hope the PAP made a mistake. William Good hoped for, quote, new dynamic leadership to rally the moderate English-speaking half of the population against the PAP, unquote, but felt it was unlikely. Not least, of course, because he seems to have overestimated how many people in Singapore spoke English. But anyway, there was little he could do, and so he resolved to sit tight as well and see how things played out. But not all the colonial officials agreed with giving the PAP its chance to run the government. Special Branch Director Kok Kai Bo, in particular, continued to insist there was an MCP conspiracy. And he credited the PAP and Workers' Party victory in the City Council to communist support. He pointed out how Lee was using communist front techniques to fix PAP's internal elections and to place his people in key positions. This, of course, as we've seen in the last episode, was true. Lee was using communist front techniques. But using communist techniques does not make you communist. And indeed, these weren't really communist techniques because underhanded politicians on the right and the left all over the world use such techniques. But Kok Kai Bo gets increasingly histrionic. If you go into the archive and you read special branch reports written by him from this period, they increasingly sound like the paranoid ravings of a somewhat disturbed mind, you know, a conspiracy hunter. Basically, he keeps saying that because Chinese PAP and Chinese Workers' Party politicians behaved in a Chinese manner, they had to be communist because China was also communist. And it took the governor himself, Governor William Good, eventually, he had to rebuke Kok Kai Bo and wrote to him, you know, in response to yet another report. Good minuted on the report and sent it back to him saying, quote, the great majority of our electorate is Chinese, and generally, their votes will go to the politicians who treat them as Chinese rather than as Malayans or British in outlook. However unpleasant this fact may be, we have to live with it, unquote. In the run-up to the 1959 elections, Kok Kai Bo tried to broker an arrangement between the right-wing parties to prevent a split of the vote. And this was illegal. A senior civil servant is not supposed to involve himself in politics. And so after the PAP election victory, he quickly resigned and moved to Kuala Lumpur. But ironically, Kok Kai Bo had been more correct than he realized. Lee Kuan Yew was working with the communists. He was working with the Malayan Communist Party. By 1958, Fong Chong Pik, or Fang Chuang Pi, was the last remaining MCP member in Singapore and in sole charge of what remained of the organization. His bosses had all fled to Riau by this time. And so in March 1958, under directions from his boss, Yu Choi Yip, who was in Riau, Fong Chong Pik reached out to Lee Kuan Yew, whom everyone knew would be Singapore's next leader, or assumed as much. And so Fong arranged a meeting. And when Lee showed up, he suggested the two of them collaborate in an anti-colonial alliance until Singapore became independent, at which point free-for-all, the alliance was over. But as long as the British were still in Singapore, they would collaborate. And this arrangement appealed to Lee because it reduced his reliance on the left-wing trade unions and their leaders. It gave him an additional tool, additional weapon, and an additional link to the grassroots. As the price for cooperation, Lee Kuan Yew asked that the MCP throw in its lot entirely with the PAP. According to Lee, what he asked for was the resignation of a Workers' Party city councillor, ideally its leader in the city council, Chang Yen-tong. And according to Lee, Fong replied that he did not know if he was an MCP cadre, but said that if he was, he would get him to resign. This was to be the first of several meetings between the two, which appeared to have reinforced mutual incomprehension. Lee overestimated the strength and influence of the communists underground, while the Malayan Communist Party believed that Lee would cooperate with them against the British for peaceful independence. Lee, of course, never planned to do such a thing. But the fact of this collaboration is perhaps the greatest hypocrisy in the official PAP history of Singapore. Lee Kuan Yew would go on to have his political rivals, his political opponents, arrested on the basis that they were communist, or at least communist sympathizers. But the government has never produced any proof that any of the detainees were participating in a communist conspiracy. And declassified special branch files show that there was never any evidence that any of them were taking part in a communist conspiracy. Now, we need to be clear about this. Yes, a small number of left-wing politicians and activists believed in communism, and yes, a few of them would have called themselves communists. But there is no evidence that they were working in the Communist Party, and indeed, many of them who wanted to work at the Communist Party were unable to get in touch with it because the Communist Party had been so destroyed by Special Branch. Even if they had worked with the Communist Party, they were not taking part in any conspiracy to violently overthrow the government. And so, they were not breaking any laws in Singapore. There was no reason to arrest any of them. On the other hand, there is a politician that we know of whom we have definitive proof that he was secretly collaborating with the Malayan Communist Party, and that was Lee Kuan Yew. And yet, when the truth came out, when Lee Kuan Yew admitted to working in the Malayan Communist Party, the British did nothing. Worse, they backed him for Prime Minister and helped arrest more people to keep him in power. This is the hypocrisy at the heart of the PAP narrative of Singapore history. It proves that the situation was never about communism. It was about power. It was about protecting British interests, and it was about keeping Lee Kuan Yew in power. More when we return. The new city council got off to a great start, but it did not last. After the first month or so, council meetings became bogged down by posturing and political point scoring. Meetings regularly ran over 14 hours long. The sheer length of the debates impeded the main council and made it impossible to get any work done. To get around this, Mayor Ong Eng Guan began ruling by decree. Opposition councillors accused him of being dictatorial and acting illegally. The Nanyang Xiangbao consulted legal experts who said it was impossible to judge because the mayor's functions were poorly defined. The mayor had the power to take temporary measures pending approval from the committees of the city council. And because the committees had PAP majorities, they would then approve his decisions after the fact. So there was legally no issue thus far. The Nanyang Xiangbao declared its support for Ong, urging him to proceed with courage. The mayor had been elected to do a job and had to be allowed to carry it out. As the Sin Chu Jit Po noted, the people were watching and would render their judgment on the situation at the Legislative Assembly elections. To win those elections, PAP rhetoric swerved towards the populace. Lee Kuan Yew declared a policy of Singapore for Singaporeans, as opposed to Singapore run for colonial benefit. He attacked the Straits Times as a conservative pro-European pro-colonial mouthpiece, writing in response to one of its articles that, quote, "If the author believes that the Chinese educated received in practice anything like equal rights and opportunities, he is living in a dream world. Important changes must take place to reduce social injustice if democracy is to survive in this country," unquote. And likewise on the campaign trail, Goh Keng Swee outlined Singapore First economic policies. Overall, parties campaigned for the elections of 1959 on a platform of economic development and competence, not ideology. Jobs, housing, and merger with the Federation of Malaya were the key issues. Security concerns focused on secret societies, not communism. Popular anti-colonialism was a result of the colonial government's perceived inability or unwillingness to govern Singapore for the benefit of its people. It wasn't about the principle of anti-colonialism, but the fact that colonialism led to discrimination and inequality and produced governments who didn't care about ordinary Singaporeans. Independence was never seen as a panacea, but rather as a means to an end, the end of raising living standards. The Sin Chew Jitpo wrote, quote, "The ultimate goal of Singapore in implementing the self-government constitution was raising living standards." And the Nanfang Evening Post, responding to British fears that Singapore was turning communist, rubbished the idea that somehow ideology somehow trumped human nature. Quote, "In critical times, people revert to looking after themselves and ideology has no bearing. When a man is hungry, he naturally thinks of food and drink. This is a natural expression of human nature." Unquote. A survey conducted by the Malayan Research Services in July and August 1958 sheds further light on Singapore's voters' outlook. While it's short of the 2,000 respondents needed to be statistically reliable, the survey was able to chart a number of trends. In some areas, an overwhelming consensus existed. Nearly 75% of all respondents were very favourable or favourable to reunification of the Federation, with only 10% opposed and the rest indifferent. Over two-thirds of Singaporeans selected unemployment as the biggest problem facing Singapore. This is more than five times more than all other problems combined. The most popular solution to unemployment was industrialization, which also drew more than all other responses. It drew more than half of all responses as the most popular solution. Support was also strong for a continued British military presence in Singapore. 65.8% was in favour versus 11.2% against and the rest undecided. Well, respondents were uncertain whether continued British military presence would provoke conflict or protect Singapore. They generally erred in favour of the British military presence because it provided employment. On the other hand, in other areas, Singapore was much more split. 51% of people were in favour of the preservation of Public Security Ordinance, the law that enabled the government to detain people for political reasons without trial, with 23.6% against and 24.8% uncertain. But the interesting thing is, when you look at the respondents, those in favour of the PPSO tended to cite the problem of secret society crime as a reason for the PPSO, which was not actually covered by the PPSO, but by the Criminal Law Temporary Provisions Act. While those against the PPSO were explicitly against the PPSO specifically and condemned it as an excuse for politically motivated arrests. When it came to the new constitution, just under half were in favour of it, as opposed to 20.4% against and 30% uncertain. But these responses were also correlated, to a certain extent, to whether the respondent felt Singaporeans were ready to govern themselves and their opinion on continued British influence on Singapore's government. So it wasn't so much about the constitution itself, but about self-perception. Was Singapore ready for independence? Or on the language of education, this was evenly split. 44% English, 33% vernacular, 11% bilingual education. But then these numbers don't hold up when you look closely, because invariably someone who said English would then say, but oh, vernacular education is also important, just slightly less important. And someone who said vernacular education was important would then say, but it's really important to also know English, just a little less important than having vernacular education. So really, everyone agreed that all the languages, and these two languages, were important. However, a large proportion of respondents also, this is very interesting, they declined to answer on political questions, including on the PPSO and the Constitution. And the report on the survey noted that many declined to answer purely out of fear of consequences. And indeed, all but one person who expressed this fear was Chinese-speaking. Only one non-Chinese respondent, who was Malay, expressed fear of political consequences. And finally, the report on the survey highlights how the largest subgroup, working-class Chinese-speaking men aged 20 to 39, were also the most cohesive in their opinions. Almost uniformly, they opposed the PPSO, they opposed the British military presence, they supported Chinese education, and they believed that Singapore should industrialize, increase trade with Eastern nations, and free its currency from British control. And most importantly to Singapore politicians, they were the most likely to vote, and they were the most likely to vote PAP. Consequently, as the PAP and Labour Front fought over this coveted demographic, their platforms targeted specifically what these people wanted the most: unemployment, housing, independence via merger, equality of language and culture, economic development via industrialization and foreign investment. In pursuit of the Chinese-speaking vote, in 1958, the Labour Front government belatedly began introducing important legislation, including bills promoting industrialization and economic development, tackling crime, reforming and lowering tax, banning yellow culture, and introducing more labour rights. A housing and development board and a People's Investment Corporation were created. Yes, you heard that right. The HDB was created by the Labour Front government. A local development bill earmarked $1.5 million to create jobs through public works. A total of $10 million in supplementary spending was passed. Whether Singapore could actually afford this was a different question, but a lot of money was being thrown about in desperation. Greater attention was laid on Chinese education. Government officials, after years of neglect or hostility to Chinese education, were suddenly and abruptly converted to its importance. The government proposed to implement 2 additional years of free education, but only after it was re-elected. It doubled educational spending and announced the opening of 100 secondary evening classes able to take 4,000 overage students. And Nanyang University, Nanta in particular, was seized upon as great potential political gain. Until this point, the Labour Front government had ignored Nanta. And to a great extent, this was good because free of interference, Nanta was able to move forward briskly, despite a lot of funding difficulties. It began classes in May 1956 to much rejoicing in the Chinese community, but the government declined to recognize its degrees. But then by the time Nanta officially opened on 30th of March 1958, political circumstances had changed. The government unexpectedly agreed to appoint a commission to examine academic standards at Nanta with the goal of recognizing Nanta degrees. It agreed to incorporate Nanta via a bill drafted entirely by Nanta's lawyers. This amounted to virtual recognition of Nanta even before the commission was appointed. And in the assembly, legislators competed with each other to praise Nanta and criticize the government for its neglect. And the government even gifted Nanta $450,000 in aid. And that's the funny thing about elections. Democracy isn't perfect, but it's the best way for our citizens to ensure that we have a government that actually governs for the benefit of the country and the people rather than for itself. And if you look at the Singapore context, democracy worked. If you think about Singapore's great achievements, the HDB, industrialization, our multilingual education system, the CPF and the general expansion of social welfare, and of course Nanta, they were all cemented or created or conceptualized as part of this great democratic contest in the late 1950s. This is the period where the ideas which then lay the foundation for Singapore's future prosperity bubble up and are fiercely debated and competed over by the various political parties and their leaders. because political parties had to compete with each other to win the votes. And in the absence of repression, in the absence of having the ability to ignore the electorate, they had to compete. They had to compete over ideas, over vision, over competence. And democracy worked. Singapore became successful and prosperous. And clearly, the right party won, because Singaporeans went on to do very well under this party. So the next time someone says that Singapore doesn't need democracy to have prosperity, as certain quarters will argue, just point out that this is untrue in Singapore history. Singapore history shows that the underpinnings of our prosperity all arose in the only period when we had genuine democracy. Singaporeans had a certain set of priorities and interests, and political parties sought to deliver it to them. And as a result, Singapore went on to great success. That's Singaporean democracy at work. Next week, we go into depth into one of these important issues that people were concerned about. I'll be sitting down with Dr. Low Kar Sing to discuss housing and the HDB in Singapore's history. Join us then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.